We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This year, the Krannert Art Museum on the University of Illinois campus is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and in this hour of the show, we have as our guest the museum's director, Kathleen Harleman. And we'll be talking a little bit about the museum, and perhaps talk about the unique role that a university-based museum plays, and how a museum like the Krannert Art Museum is different from, say, a big city museum like, oh, for example, the Chicago Art Institute. We'll talk about some of the things that perhaps have been going on there already this year as they're celebrating their 50th anniversary year, and in addition, talk about some of the things that they have planned for the fall. And questions from folks who are listening are certainly welcome. If you would like to be a part of the show, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. The call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. And we can also take emails if you'd like to send in a question or comment that way. And the address is willtalk, got to put that hyphen in there, though, willtalk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call, and we'd be very happy to bring you into the conversation. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm delighted. Thanks for inviting me.
And maybe we ought to say right up front here, I expect that after listening to the conversation, there will be people who will become very excited about the idea of going to the museum. And I think we do have to say to folks, the museum actually is closed at the moment. It's closed for the summertime because you're doing a number of renovations and you're getting ready for a new big exhibition, which we can talk about. So it's, sadly enough, people are going to have to wait. They cannot go right away.
But we're there. We can be responsive in terms of phone calls and emails. And if anyone's desperate to do something, just give us a call because we want to be there for the community and the campus.
Well, and you were nice enough to welcome Harriet Williamson, my producer, and me to the museum the other day just to walk around a little bit. And right at the moment, a lot of the galleries are empty because you're doing work on the museum. And I don't know how this question sort of occurred to me. Had you ever had the opportunity before to walk around the museum like that, when essentially there was so much of it where there was nothing there, just bare walls?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is a bit of a freaky experience just to see all these walls with the remnants of where paintings used to hang and the discoloration from that. So this is the first time in decades that these works have been removed completely from these galleries, and that the walls are going to get a fresh paint job, and they're going to be new arrangements, new adjacencies, things pulled from places they haven't been before. So we're hoping it'll also be a bit of a surprise and a delight when we open again.
We did in fact go into one gallery where you could see the shadows, the ghostly, where the paint had faded except for the place where the pictures had hung. So you actually could see that there was these darker squares and rectangles where the paintings had been. Well, does that start you thinking about other aspects of the place, that is, the building, what it is, how it functions, what it feels like, without any of the things that people actually come to see being there?
Well, there actually have been situations. One of the most obvious was in Berlin, a Holocaust museum that was designed by Daniel Libeskind, an American architect. And the building was a very dramatic form. It really responded to issues of Holocaust history. And for a whole first year when that building opened, it was completely empty of art because the architecture was so powerful and so strong. So there have been situations where the art has not been added till later. But I think in our situation, we really need to work with the volumes, the different spaces. And we really do have a building that's undergone three different phases of expansion.
Mm-hmm. Now, the first building, so that dates from 1961, so that's how it is. We're talking about 50 years. But going back further than that, there were people here on the campus of the University of Illinois who felt that having art available for students and other people to see was an important thing.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the most remarkable things about this campus that within the first decade of the University of Illinois being founded in 1867, there was actually an amazing fine arts gallery that was set up. And if you think about the year that it was established, which was 1875, that was only 5 years after the Metropolitan Museum in New York opened. So that was a pretty big deal. Mm-hmm. And it really related to the University of Illinois' first regent. His name was John Milton Gregory. And he really believed that art was extremely important. And while he felt that the economics on the campus didn't allow him to ask for money, he went around this community and he managed to raise about $3,000. He bought his own boat ticket, went over to Europe, and spent months gathering works of art that he could bring back here. And among the works that he brought back were 260 plaster casts of statues and busts, about 300 photographs of famous paintings and scenes of Italy and Switzerland, and some wonderful lithograph historical portraits. So he brought copies of great, amazing works of art, but he also brought some original ones, and that's what first established that gallery on this campus.
Mm-hmm. Now, the few of those plaster casts that exist are still on the campus. They're at the Spurlock Museum, so people can see them there. A little bit earlier this winter, Wayne Petard, who runs the place there, was here, and we talked about that. And he explained that at one point, it was actually very common. There were only so many great pieces of sculpture to go around, and one of the things that was commonly done was plaster casts would be made so that at least then people could see in three dimensions. They could see the object, they could actually see it, they could walk around it, and that was a very common thing for museums to have, that is, copies in plaster of important pieces of sculpture.
Absolutely. I mean, we shared that with Harvard Museum. They have hundreds and thousands of copies. The problem is that over time, many of these were destroyed and in bad disrepair. So the Spurlock is a wonderful repository for those, but unfortunately it's just a small fraction of what was originally here.
Well, and now in your museum, you can see some of these very first, or it must be in your collection, they may not always be on display, but you can see some of these very first acquisitions?
You can, absolutely. We have about 10,000 works in the collection, and obviously only a small percentage of those can be up at any one time. But I think what's great about the collection is the fact that the university has been collecting works of art, not just this first foray to Europe, but ever since then, way before the museum was built. And so then over time, all of these collections came to us or the Spurlock Museum.
Yeah. I know that in the case of the Gregory and his effort to bring the plaster cast, that there were some people on the campus that thought that it was just not important. You know, this was particularly at the time when the influence of the university was to give people practical kind of training, mm-hmm. so they could go out there and do particular kinds of work and build the economy and build the state. And I'm sure that there were people who thought, well, if the students looking at sculpture was sort of far down on the list. How did people in those early days make the argument that acquiring art was something that it would be good for the university to do?
Well, I think it took visionaries like Gregory to build the case that an education needed to add all of these parts. I mean, it's true, the role of the arts before the 20s and 30s on this campus was really as a service to engineering and to architecture, teaching drawing to architecture students, teaching ceramics to engineering, chemical engineering students. So the role was definitely subservient, but I think what has impressed me about this campus is the visionary insight to doing some very brave and amazing things. And one of them was from 1948 to 74, establishing a series of exhibitions on this campus called the Contemporary American Painting and Sculpture Shows that brought some of the major artists from all around the world, their works to this campus, purchased them. Eventually they went into the museum's collection. And it was a totally brave and bold and almost crazy thing to do.
Just because of where we were talking about, or because of the works themselves?
Well, I think it was a surprise to everyone for an institution, a university campus in the middle of the corn and soybean fields to be doing this. And at the time, of course, and it's still true to this day, New York and Chicago and other places held pride of place in terms of their collections. So it was looked at as like, what is going on in the middle of these fields? All this attention focused on this, and there was real money given to artists for the purchase of their works. It was the second highest prize for art awards in the whole country. So it was done strategically and really smartly.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that even in the, maybe it was the late 50s or the 60s, the people were some people in the art world were talking maybe a little dismissively about the University of Illinois Museum, its aspirations. And again, there was an awful lot of this talk about, you know, the museum in the cornfield, that
exactly.
kind of stuff.
I mean, there was a cover in the 50s of Look magazine just almost making fun of the fact that this was happening, a bit of confusion about, is this really a great thing or is it just like the silliest thing we've ever heard? So people were trying to figure it out, but I think the consensus now is that some amazing works were purchased and those exhibitions were really important to student and faculty and community life here.
Our guest in this hour of focus is the director of the Crannett Art Museum, Kathleen Harleman. She's been here for a number of years. Before that, worked in a number of places, including the Bellevue Art Museum in Seattle. She was consultant to the Canadian Center for Architecture in Montreal. She's also been director and chief executive officer of the Museum of Art in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and director, associate director, director of cultural and academic programs at Wellesley College's Davis Museum and Cultural Center. And we're pleased that she could be here on the program to talk a little bit about the museum, which is now celebrating 50 years this year. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. One of the things that you suggest we might talk about, and I think this is interesting, and that is to talk about the role of the university-based museum, like the Crannett Museum, and how it is different from the kind of institutions that people no doubt have visited in a lot of big cities. We have one not all that far away. You know, there are good museums in Indianapolis and in Chicago and in St. Louis, very fine museums. How do you see the mission of the Crannett Art Museum as being different from a museum like that, like those?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Think with a museum like ourselves, we're trying to balance our role as a public institution. And when I say public institution, I am thinking about places like Indianapolis Museum of Art, the Art Institute of Chicago, Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. But we also are part of a university, and that provides unique opportunities. Speaking a little bit about the similarities with public institutions, Art Institute of Chicago has a huge collection. You would call it encyclopedic. We have a much smaller collection. As I said, it's about 10,000 objects, but it is what I would maybe call panoramic. It does have a span of culture and time periods, and it's a wonderful teaching resource. A museum like the Contemporary in Chicago focuses predominantly on contemporary art, and that's something we're also balancing. We're not only a place of historical collections, but we are attempting to be part of the contemporary art world. So a lot of the exhibitions, I'd say the majority that we organize, are actually in the realm of contemporary art. So in that way, we're having a dialogue with institutions that I just named. But the real difference is the fact that we are in a university campus, and it's possible to be a university museum without any contact with a campus and with a curriculum. And there are actually a number of places that really do not have an engaged dialogue. But it's something very important for the Crannett Art Museum to be an equal partner with its local, regional, national community, and a very also strong partner with the campus. And the way that we do that is we work with students and faculty to organize exhibitions, to develop publications, to come up with programs that involve artists coming to campus, critiquing student work. Many of our staff members teach full classes every semester, some of them just individual classes. But it's essential for us to be integrated into the curriculum and really be perceived as a partner intellectually, socially, a place for people to come. And the results, the benefits we get are really amazing. It allows us to triple or quadruple the work we can do And I think it's an important mission.
So how many visitors does the museum get every year?
We get about 125 to 135,000. And that happens because we're a destination for art, but we're also a place that has classrooms. We have an auditorium that holds about 140. Classes are taught throughout the day. We have seminar spaces, and we have a cafe. So it's the composite of people coming in to see art, come in to take yoga lessons, tango classes, the whole wide spectrum of things that you can do actually at the museum.
Yeah, and it's also, it functions as an important educational resource. You also have a center there for teachers who are interested in teaching art in their classrooms, then can come for you to have things that they can use in teaching. And I'm assuming that also you put on various kinds of programs for them to learn things that then they can take into the classroom.
Yes, the role in the schools, K through 12, is also a really important thing to focus on, particularly these days as attention to the arts has been decreasing. But there is a marvelous resource in the museum called the Gertz Education Center, and it's been around for over a decade. There are thousands of objects that go out every year to classrooms, and they're used by teachers and students to teach from. They can be held, they can be looked at very, very closely, and so it's a very different experience from works in the museum that tend to be behind glass, in frames, in vitrines. And we are also really proud of our docent program. A docent is a person who gets trained in art and then is able to give tours to school children, the general public, and this has been one of our major initiatives for the 50th, to develop a whole new training program. It's a two-year program, and we have close to 20 marvelous members of this community who come in every week and really do their homework and enjoy it, I think, quite a lot.
Yeah. I'm sure that over time the collection has grown as things have been acquired, as people have come along and wanted to give things to the museum. And managing what you have and doing that in a way, trying to do that in a way that reflects this panoramic objective. So I'm sure that it would be, even if you said you were going to have a museum and everything in it would be, say, 20th century forward, that's still a lot of artists and a lot of work to cover. But you have things going back to the ancient Near East and East Asia and forward all the way to contemporary art. How do you think about balancing all of that, particularly when it comes to acquiring new things for the museum?
Well, that's a really complicated, good question, because there's so many blanks that could be filled, and it's not like you can always just make a list of the individual things you want and somehow you have the money to get them or the gifts come from the sky. So we try to build on the strengths that are there, things like pre-Columbian, African, you mentioned Asian, our 20th century collection that came through these exhibitions we just talked about from 1948 to 74, and an amazing photographs and prints collection. But this has also been another initiative of the 50th anniversary to really go out and solicit as many great acquisitions as we possibly could find. So they've come in wonderful numbers, both from generous gifts, some from alums to the university, others from people who may not have had any contact with the museum in the past but heard about this push to get new works. Sometimes we've purchased individual works of art, and they tend to be ones where we're thinking about a reinstallation of a permanent gallery. You talked about these empty walls. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about how to change them, make them different. So we're being very focused and specific on what could really excite the visitor in terms of new adjacencies, new contexts. And then we're also going after collections, multiple ones, individual works from people who are willing to put the funds out there and help us collectively decide to acquire special things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you touched on something that I think is interesting, and I'm sure that it's also can be kind of tricky, how displaying things that are not, they're not organized chronologically. They're not organized according to source. So for example, you go someplace like the Art Institute. There are galleries where everything is East Asian. Mm-hmm. That's what you're going to see there. There are galleries where everything is pre-Columbian. Then there are galleries where there's art, and maybe all the artists are American. And so you start with early America and you come forward. Or maybe you start walking through galleries and it's European and there's stuff from the Middle Ages and then there's stuff from the Renaissance and there's stuff from the 16th century and the 17th century, the 18th century.
Right.
And then maybe you go into another section in the museum and it's all stuff that was done after 1900. So that's certainly one way of organizing things according to culture, according to geographical region, or chronologically. But now you're talking about, and in fact, you have something coming up here this fall that is a completely different approach to putting things together.
Yes, and we may be called crazy, but we think it's going to be quite exciting. It's called At 50, and we have invited a wonderful curator. He used to be the director of the Rose Art Gallery at Brandeis University, which is another interesting issue related to museums and their universities, which we might get into. But he is coming. He's in love. He's known as a contemporary scholar, an expert in new media, video. But in the last years working at the Rose and exploring our collection, he has fallen in love with collections from the beginning of time to the present. And so he has the opportunity to come in and just mix things up. And he is an intellectual, but he is not going to be constructing an intellectual framework to this. When you walk into this show that opens August 25th and runs through the fall, you will go into our big exhibition, temporary exhibition space, and you're going to see platforms that actually, during the course of the exhibition, will turn, and works of art from across totally different centuries and cultures will be juxtaposed in ways that they've never been seen before in the museum. So we think it's going to be a good opportunity just to see an African mask next to a Western portrait, to see video projections on the wall of the latest of contemporary art next to beautiful WPA prints. They're just going to be surprising ways that you're going to look at these objects. And it doesn't mean it, in the future it'll replace all those wonderful geographic and time-sensitive concentrations. Mm. It's just going to get you to think in a slightly different way.
So this is even going beyond the idea that, well, some European artists were influenced by and got excited by looking at African traditional art and somehow incorporated that. Or there were times when European artists looked at East Asian art and just got very excited about it and then took things from that and brought it into their own art. It's a different thing from hanging, you know, a Picasso next to an African mask. This sounds like it's much more of a personal sort of idiosyncratic look on his part of just a couple of things that he really likes and something about them. He sees some kind of connection, so he's putting the two things together.
I think that's true. And I think the thing to be learned from it is that we could each do that. We can walk into the museum and we can figure out the kinds of things that we'd like to think about next to, even if they're not physically there, they're going to spark our imagination. So it's personal, it's his vision, but the attempt is to make us each take this kind of brave step and think in ways we haven't before.
So you don't know what it's going to look like?
Well,
or do you have sort of an idea what it's going to look like?
I do. I mean, he's required to give us lists of what has to be conserved and framed, and so there's actually a lot of work going on right now to do that. But I can't quite figure out how I'm going to feel when I walk in there. So I'm really hoping that lots of people come out, let us know how they feel. He'll be in attendance for the opening. There'll be a video that tries to explain some of the things he's really excited about. And I really do think it's a great way to celebrate the end of one set of 50 years and then what the future offers, which, you know, can be bold and different and probably will be.
Yeah. Now, and when will this open?
This opens the evening of August 25th. That's a Thursday. And we'll be opening other shows, recent acquisitions from the last 5 years. And you'll get to see what I spoke about, the amazing gifts and purchases that have been made in honor of this 50th anniversary. And then there'll be a wonderful exhibition related to the South African artist Marian Makeba, and that will be very contemporary, full of music and just terrific for all ages and interests.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a lot of great things going on there. And again, if people have just joined us, we're talking here this morning with Kathleen Harleman. She's director of the Krannert Art Museum on the campus of the University of Illinois, celebrating this year 50 years in its current building, although some of the things that are in the museum have been on this campus one place or another for more than 50 years, but the museum itself has been around 50 years. We thought it'd be fun to have her in here to talk a little bit. And as I mentioned, though, at the beginning of the program, the museum actually is closed for the summer because they are doing a lot of renovation of the museum. So make your date on the calendar for August, because you're going to want to go and see the museum at the point that it reopens. Questions, comments, too, are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I'm curious, going back to the idea that you look over your collection and you see what you have, and then you say, well, here are holes, in the sense that it would be great to have some particular work to, I don't know if that means representing a particular artist or period or whatever. So is it more the case that you, and if you're soliciting a gift, because I'm sure, you know, you spend a lot of time doing that, is it the case that more that you have somebody who is a supporter that wants to support your work and is willing to give you some money so you can go out and buy something? Or do you often have a particular work in mind, you know who's got it, mm-hmm. and you actually approach that person, I suppose it could be an institution, saying, well, would you be interested in parting with this? How do you do that?
Well, I think there are a variety of ways. I mean, filling in blanks also can be done through loans. So even for this show that we were just talking about, mm-hmm. that features our collection, we are going to have loans of many of these contemporary videos. So you don't always have to acquire something permanently. I mean, this is a much cheaper, easier way to go when you request loans from other institutions. And incidentally, we loan about 30 objects from our own collection each year to other institutions in this way. But I think what the 50th has shown is there have been some really wonderful kinds of partnerships. And one of my favorites is a couple in this community. And we've been working, and when I say we, myself and one of our curators, and a curator is someone who helps make acquisitions, develops exhibitions and publications. But we've been working together to try to come up with some wonderful works by the French 19th century artist Théodore Géricault. We don't have any works by him in the collection. He is an artist that all four of us really respond to. So for the last year, we've been working together, looking at the markets, finding out what's being auctioned, what's for sale. And recently, we've met with great success, and we've just acquired four really wonderful prints by this artist. So these works will be part of this recent acquisition show that will go on view. But I think it's that process of getting these prints into the collection that was so exciting. It's kind of a shared passion, doing the research, talking it through. And that's a really exciting partnership to have with people who want to help the collection. Mm-hmm. There are other people who choose to write wonderful checks. They leave it up to you what to acquire. You tell them, you give them sometimes a choice between two objects. That's happened recently for the 50th. And I think there's some sense of real joy from them being part of that kind of process, yeah. as well.
And how do you can you keep yourself out of this, in the sense that maybe there's something that you personally like, or some artist that you personally think is important, and where I'm sure you could make the case for mm-hmm. for that person being important. But part of it is just you think, I really love this particular artist. I love this work. Maybe a particular work. You say, boy, I just think that that's one of the most fabulous things. If I could have it on my wall, I would, but having it on the wall of the museum, that would be good too.
Well, I have to admit, with this Géricault acquisition, one of the best courses I took in graduate school was with the art historian Michael Fried, and he taught the best seminar on Géricault. So this project has been a little bit of personal search, as well as one that I think the institution will really benefit from. So I think having passion and commitment with the artists we acquire is really important, and I think we've got it with our small staff.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Kathleen Harleman. She's director of the Krannert Art Museum on the U of I campus. We'll talk some more in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Amber Glenn Alzheimer's Special Care Center in Urbana. Amber Glenn incorporates residents' past routines and interests into their daily lives, engaging residents in choices and daily living patterns. More information is available at 384-0100.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here with a number of different things every week throughout the week, and we try to mix it up so there's a lot of variety. In the second hour today, Matt Ehrlich will be with us. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois. We'll talk about a period after World War II where there was a golden age of audio documentary, and it was being done by commercial radio networks like CBS. He's written about this in his new book, Radio Utopia. Tomorrow morning at 10, our guest is Richard Harwood, founder and president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation, an institution that has been very influential with nonprofit organizations like public broadcasters, but also schools, museums, and helping them think about how they want to be involved in the civic life of their communities and what it is that takes people that it takes to get people involved in public life. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow. Also tomorrow, we'll talk about the coming of the e-book and how that is changing the experience of reading and the experience of publishing. And we'll have two guests with us here in the studio, Philip Graham, who's professor of English and creative writing at the University of Illinois. He's also a poet, novelist, as well as Martin Riker, who is associate director of the Dahlke Archive Press. Both of them here to talk about how electronic books and things like the Kindle and the iPad are changing reading and publishing. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can listen to past shows, and you can look at the schedule for the rest of this week and next week and as far as it goes. In this part of the show, we are talking about the Krannert Art Museum on the U of I campus celebrating 50 years this year. Kathleen Harleman is our guest. She's director of the museum. And questions, of course, as always, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm just, again, going back to, we talked a little bit at the beginning about how I had a chance to go over to the museum and walk around a little bit, and you're doing a lot of renovating, so there are a lot of bare walls, which gets you thinking, well, you know, here you go into a particular gallery, and it's a space, you know, there's floor, walls, ceiling. What can you do, actually? You know, you could paint the walls a particular color, and I guess that, so a lot of thought goes into that. There's issues with lighting. But how many different things can you do if you're essentially just talking about a room and you have things, pretty much things hanging on the wall? How many different things can, how many different ways can you manipulate that would affect the experience of looking at the art?
Well, those of you who have been to the museum in the last years probably recognize that there wasn't a lot of integration of objects with, for instance, paintings. So one of the things you're going to see is taking objects from the Moore collection of decorative arts downstairs and integrating more of them into the experience of a culture and a time period. But I think down the road, and it's going to take probably another year or so, if you come into the newly configured African Gallery, you're going to see the steps of what we really want to make happen for the future. You'll see more of an integration of historical modern African material with contemporary African and African American. You'll see color images, but you're also going to see a technology advance in terms of iPads that present masquerades that take these objects in the context in which they were originally conceived and have a sense for it. So I think the way that you start to transform these spaces is through the enlivenment of interpretation and ways of establishing context that helps people understand that, yes, taking an object out of a church and putting it into a gallery is already a huge step out of context. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to try to help people understand where these things came from and why they're here at the museum. Another way to transform spaces probably happens for us more in our temporary exhibitions. And we often, for our big shows, use the resources of an exhibition designer or architect to really transform the spaces. So over the last 5 to 6 years, you could have walked in our East Gallery and seen totally different installations of works of art. In one case, they were hanging from the ceilings, totally unsupported from the floor, just in the center of the space. Another show dealing with facades, the idea of the architectural frontage of things, took walls that were just built out of studs and used that as a type of vocabulary with the art. So I think there are ways to play with it, and it's probably not totally out of character that we're going to have these turning platforms and actually freestanding walls in this new show that opens in August, because we like to play with the space and make people sometimes surprised by what can happen in it. Mm.
Is that something that's relatively new, that idea that you really to engage people and to enhance the experience of seeing the object, you have to go beyond simply showing them the object and then maybe putting a little little label that says what it is next to it?
I think fundamentally museums are changing, that the mission and the creed of museums has always been to acquire, protect, conserve objects. And often museums are compared to churches and sacred places. And more museums around the world are definitely changing into spaces of a whole different kind of experience, not just the sacred, the quiet place, but places where performances are undertaken, experimentation, trying things, being open to the fact that they may not succeed. And that is true of the way that cultures are displayed. There have been very large controversies about adjacencies and contexts that museums have implemented, and they've provoked great deals of response from the peoples that they reflect. So I think it's an area that museums are becoming braver in terms of experimentation. And we think it's important, particularly in a university museum, to use the expertise that's here and challenge some of these assumptions of what a culture means and what these objects' role in that culture really were. Mm-hmm.
We have a caller. Well, let's talk with them. Someone here in Champaign County where we are. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. A couple of things you were just talking about were sort of resonating with me, so I decided to call. The performance aspect, I've enjoyed quite a bit some of the avant-garde sudden sound and the tango live music with dancers and all of that sort of thing. And the remarks about how it looks empty and just sort of warehouse-like, you want the background to be somewhat neutral, I guess, for presentation. But I was thinking of some kind of performance alcove or something that would be multi-purpose, that would be a little break up the space and be a sound stage for the performances if it was adequate to the particular ensemble. And but it would also be useful for presenting sort of, miniatures or something that where you wanted to have a little more intimate space for the viewer or experiencer, in case there's multimedia involved. I don't know, is that something your architect's been preoccupied with in any way, or can you tell me some things about that?
Certainly. We tried an experiment last spring, and this was part of our 50th anniversary. It was called Open Studio, and instead of having an exhibition in our largest exhibition space, we totally emptied it. We did get this wonderful project from a Chicago-based artist, Juan Chavez, called Speaker Project, and we set it up in the back of the room. And it was there for the duration of Open Studio, and it was really a place for musicians to come and to perform inside and around it. And we had some things that were programmed, but it was also just open for people to come. And I think it worked. At the same time, we used the front part of the space for two artists in residence, one from Trinidad and one from Zimbabwe. And these were kind of wonderful artists who used performance as their medium. They engaged students, they worked with the community, they came up with processions, they came up with projects. And it was an experiment for us to see if this might be something we want to do on a regular basis. As you probably understand, the museum is a bit limited in terms of high volume spaces with great sound systems where we can just all the time do performance. So what we've had to do all along is to take our gallery spaces and have the Sudden Sound concert series, the Voice series, all these things happening with the art as a backdrop, which I think adds something to a musical performance, a voice presentation that's different from a theater in a performing arts center. But I think you raise a really important point, and that is if I had anything to be added to the museum, it would be more spaces for performance. And I think the intimacy you're talking about in one of my other museums, we actually created a wonderful little video area. It was a kind of pole vaulting bench or cushion that was established. Video monitors were hung from the ceiling, and students and others spent time with their headphones lying on this pole vaulting cushion, watching videos, and it was kind of a wonderful, intimate, small experience. So we want to make more of these things happen in the museum, and carving out spaces is important. Hmm.
Well, do you have some kind of very long-term ideas about the possibility? I'm sure that funds make this limited, and I don't know what possibility there is actually for expansion in terms of whether the ground is actually available, even if you wanted to do that. Some possibility that over 10, 20, 30, you know, what kind of time frame you want to use, that you might think about adding physical space to the museum?
It's definitely on our mind. Right now we're focusing on just trying to make the space work a lot better, look better. It needs to be loved, and that's what this closure, the paint jobs, the more radical changes to galleries and public spaces will be about. But the next iteration is definitely about adding on, maybe reaching over to the business instructional facility, the new building across the big lawn that separates the museum and the business school. And we think that that would be a wonderful relationship with the business school. It would also capture a lot of the traffic that goes along past the School of Art and Design to the residences south of campus. So I think there are lots of opportunities, but it will take funds that at the moment we don't have.
Mm. We have another caller here. About 10 minutes left, by the way. Our guest in this hour of focus is Kathleen Harleman. She's director of the Krannert Art Museum on the campus of the University of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Yeah, I need help in what the name of it was, but you had a exhibit there with the monks, and they created this with sand, different colored sand. It was a spiritual thing. Do you recall that?
Mandela, yes.
And you actually, were they actually, which was unusual, it was kept in place, and usually it's destroyed afterward, correct?
I think so.
Okay, but very impressive. I didn't see the actual process, but, you know, with small bits of sand, they create this spiritual thing, but pretty impressive.
Thank you. That actually happened with my predecessor, Joseph Helfenstein, but it's one of the events that a lot of people keep referring back to, so I think it's really something to think about for the future.
Do you recall what year that was or not?
The monks, the Mandela that mm-hmm. they created? Yes. And as I said, it was before my time, but it's certainly referred to as a wonderful initiative. It was very moving and very powerful.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Well, that's something sort of unusual, but do you, in the sense that it was an opportunity for people to see something be created, because mm-hmm. the idea was that as the monks made this incredibly elaborate painting using these colored grains of sand, which they literally sprinkle through their fingers to make this thing. The exciting part of the exciting thing of it was that you could actually stand there and watch them do it. I don't know what sort of opportunities there might be, but had you thought about creating opportunities, bringing artists in, have them make art, and let people watch?
Yes, and in fact, we had a wonderful experience this past spring when we opened something called the Kangoric Epic, and it was in one of our smaller galleries. The walls were all painted black, and two artists from Brooklyn came to campus. They came a couple of days before the opening, and they stayed a couple days afterwards. And during that time, certainly during the opening, they took chalk and made this completely freehand drawing on all four walls of the gallery that spoke to our location, where we are, issues that were going on in the world at the time. And I think it was just a really exciting experience, both for the artist making the art in the presence of the audience, but also for people wandering in. Certainly children loved it. Yeah. It stayed up for the whole year. But I think that kind of active engagement, not knowing exactly what you're going to get, is really important for the future of where the museum needs to be going.
And as is usually the case with the sand mandala, in this particular case, then when it was done, somebody came in and wiped it. They rubbed it all out. So it was there for a while. You could see it being created. It was there for a while, but then at some point someone came and erased it.
Exactly.
So that
and that's the tragic part. That's when you start crying and say, does it really have to go? But that's also part of the world of contemporary art, that ephemera is also of value.
Yeah. Well, again, somebody wants to call real quick here with a question. We have about 5-6 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So this is we're in the middle now of the 50th anniversary year, and you're getting ready for the museum to reopen a little bit later this summer. Are there some particular things that will be going? And we've mentioned a little bit this exhibition where you brought in this curator to do this unusual thing, where he has pulled different things from your collections, supplemented with images of some other things that he couldn't actually have the physical thing, but we could have.
Well,
the
actually, they are works of art. They're videos.
Okay. So yeah, it's actually video art. Oh, I misunderstood that it wasn't video of some other art.
No.
It was a piece of video art. Very well. So what he's done is he has a particular vision, drawing these things that would not ordinarily be in the same room together and putting them together. So that's sort of the first big thing that's going to kick off the season when you reopen. Are there some other particular things that will be happening then from August until the end of the year that you might want to mention?
Certainly. As I said, we also are going to show the results of this wonderful search for new objects. And so I think that will also be interesting for people to see what can happen when they either give their own collections or participate in a kind of dialogue with us to find out what we need. Our contemporary commitment, as I said, is going to be there in the form of this show called Makeba. And once again, this is introducing music into what we do as an institution. The music of Marian Makeba will be there, but it's also an artist taking the amazing record covers of her work and building this kind of profile of a personality in South Africa that has had such an impact on music. So once again, continuing our commitment to contemporary production, it's also about, you know, one artist's collection. So in a way, it relates back to the fact that we're showing how a collection is built. We're showing how a collection can be mixed up and shown in interesting ways. And then the choice of this African Seaman Allen artist who's taking the record covers of Makeba is showing what a contemporary collection can look like in the art world. And incidentally, this artist is being featured right now at the Venice Biennale, and he's an interesting hot person on the international scene. I think the other things that will take longer for people to see, we've undergone some wonderful, somewhat invisible changes to the building. The university contributed generously to creating a whole new environment for a more stable temperature and humidity. We have been, over the years, wired for internet and wireless internet. And all of these things are actually really important in transforming the museum into a place where people can bring their laptops, can feel more comfortable in terms of technology. We can do more of these things, as I spoke about with iPads. And over time, you're going to see much more radical transformations of the way that art is displayed and interpreted. And we're trying to make investments not just in exhibitions, but in really making the collection a more exciting place. In the beginning, when I first came here, 2/3 of our efforts and our resources went to exhibitions, and now we're trying to balance that out, because these are the most phenomenal assets that the university, the state of Illinois, and all of us have.
Yeah. Just to come back just for a second, we're coming down, we have a couple of minutes left, but I think people should appreciate, we talked earlier about your doing some renovations just in terms of looking at lighting and looking at walls that needed to be repainted. But I don't know that if people really appreciate that that you have to give a lot of thought to temperature and humidity in the building. You don't want wide swings, and it's not just to make the people who come to see the art comfortable, it's to make the art comfortable. And that is that you have to, you know, to keep it alive as long as you possibly can, you have to be very conscious of these sorts of things. And I imagine that's an aspect of the museum that people who come into it probably don't really think very much
about. I think you're absolutely right. And I really do credit the university for hearing what we said. It's very important for this collection, which has not just great monetary value, but incredible cultural value, to be preserved over time. And then the other aspect is when we want to loan from other institutions. In the past, many of them have said no because our conditions were not up to their standards. So this is going to allow us a much greater latitude of borrowing from other places and probably most importantly, really taking care of our own collection.
So there were places where you would like to have, they had something you would like to have to put on display for a while, and they, when they assessed the conditions in the museum, they said, no, sorry, we're not going to do it.
Absolutely. Even with the recent exhibition of Annette Lemire, one work was not allowed to come to us, but when we traveled the show to other venues, it was allowed to travel because their environment was a lot better than ours. So, you know, there's some tough knocks with that, and we're hoping that this investment will really help.
Is there some sort of certification body that goes around to museums and checks all that stuff
out? There really is. It's just like universities. You get accredited. We just went actually through another accreditation that'll be good for 10 to 15 years, but they withheld the accreditation until they were convinced that the environment was going to be fixed. And in a sense, they did us a service by doing that. But we're fully accredited, and we're good to go.
All right. Well, that's where we'll have to leave it here, with our thanks to Kathleen Harleman. She's director of the Krannert Art Museum on the University of Illinois campus. Closed for the summer, but when will you be reopening again?
August 23rd, in advance of the opening the night of August 25th. So we want to be ready with the classes and welcoming students and all of you to come.
All right. Thanks very much for
Thank
being with
you.
Us.